Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's Tabletop Gaming Advice Podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by our awesome Patreon backers like the dauntless Dungeon Masters Block, the great GM Gerrymander, and the captivating Craig. Today, we have me, Ange, along with Chris and JT, and we are going to discuss narrative positioning and what that means for you, your players, and your games. Before we dive into the main topic, though, we're going to ask our Get to Know a Gnome question. What kind of scene do you instantly want to play in that engages you completely? For example, a rooftop chase, a tense negotiation, a spooky investigation, a last stand, etc. Chris, I'm going to go with you first.
I like any kind of action sequence that opens up a game, opens up a session, things like that. It can be a chase, it can be a fight, but I like it when it's like in media res too. We just start in the middle of the action. That's kind of my favorite thing. That's what I like.
Those are always fun. What about you, JT?
So for me, it's getting involved in a good mystery, like quickly involved in a good mystery that has just a really simple concept. And then let it expand from there. So like the solving of the initial mystery may be halfway through session one, but you'll land more clues or questions or be exposed to more bad guys, whatever it is that lead to more adventures from there. But getting that initial hook, it's a mysterious hook, like what the hell's going on or who's missing or, hey, we got to go find a guy or whatever it is. I love getting started that way because of the explosive manner that the storyline tree can evolve into.
For me, I kind of came at this from a like almost like a setting perspective, because I adore a good fair, carnival, amusement park, that type of thing. Give me a crowded location with people all engaging in fun or cultural activities, and then have something mysterious or creepy or clandestine or dangerous start happening in the background that the PCs need to engage with. So for me as a player or me as a GM, it feels like it's a very easy setting for people to kind of grasp hold of and know kind of what they're in the middle of doing or where they are as they're engaging with whatever flavor of the adventure is. I actually have to be careful with this one and put it into adventures a little too often, to the point that I actually had somebody go, I think I played this adventure before. And I'm like, I know you haven't because I just made this one up. It's just very similar to another one you played.
So the carnival is an Ange trope?
The carnival is an Ange trope.
There you go.
Very much is an Ange trope. You always need to be careful of your tropes. So moving on into our main topic of discussion. If you're here listening to us, you likely love role-playing games as much as those of us here as we talk about them. RPGs are all in varying degrees some combination of mechanics and collaborative storytelling. We want to dive in and talk about how the narrative affects gameplay and vice versa, how gameplay affects narrative. How should we and our players use narrative positioning to make our games better? And we're going to start off with defining it. What do we mean by narrative positioning? Chris, I'm going to have you take this one.
The simplest definition of narrative positioning is that the context of the narrative impacts the gameplay part of the RPG in some way. And that will differ depending on game and mechanics.
Now, is this something exclusive to indie story games, or is this also relevant for games with more traditional mechanics?
So from my experience, the concept was the mechanical concept, like, you know, a meta currency probably came from indie games. That's where I first saw it, at least. And it's been adopted by a broad spectrum of games, including those with more traditional mechanics. I can't really think of anything providing narrative positioning in D&D until Inspiration hit with 5th edition. And even then, it's more commonly used for the reroll with advantage mechanic, as opposed to a narrative positioning thing. But I've always, regardless of the mechanics in the book, if a player says, hey, I got a great idea, can I do blah, blah, blah? If it fits within the scope of reality within the game itself, I'll be like, yeah, sure, go for it. Let's chat about it and see what skill or what difficulty or what preparations you have to make to modify the story with your really cool idea.
I think to a certain degree, like many mechanics that get added to games, these are sometimes based in trying to model what some good GMs do as instinct. And it basically helps make the concepts more accessible to those trying to learn how to run games. So if you have a mechanic like inspiration, like advantage, disadvantage, like the Benny, like the way traits and stuff are used in Cortex, it's something that can reward the player for the way they've positioned their character inside the narrative of the game.
Everything that you both said, I'm on board with. The inspiration, the Benny for me are the traditional games that people play that have a mechanic that is based on narrative positioning. Inspiration can be gained through narrative positioning, depending on what your character's motivations, flaws, all that stuff from 5th edition. And it, as we've modified it over the course of time, some people play with luck from Tales of the Valiant, where you can get it by playing to the character, which is part of narrative positioning, right? If your character, this is the one that I wanted to throw out there, Ange, like if you're playing a game that's about heroic fantasy, because you're always like, we should be the big damn heroes, you can be like, all right, we're going to provide inspiration when you are a big damn hero in play.
Right.
That is a narrative positioning mechanic. Do the same thing for the Benny.
But that wouldn't necessarily work as well in a game that's trying to be a survival horror game. You don't want to necessarily encourage that type of thing in a survival horror because that's not what the narrative of the game is pushing for.
Correct. Absolutely. So that is so then we would be like, if you do the survival thing, right? Like you can even put out there like they have in some video games, you could adopt these mechanics. Not that they exist in any role-playing games that I can think of, because I don't know how many survivalist like Valheims or your even Minecrafts role-playing type games are out there. But if you could put that same mechanic in the game of like, if you acquire enough things to build this thing, then you get a whatever the meta currency of that game would be. Now, I'm talking about games that actually exist. So we're talking like Savage Worlds with the Benny and Inspiration with D&D are the ones that are probably the most prominent.
Yeah. I know Cortex has some sort of, it's not a Benny, plot points.
Yes.
They have plot points, which can function in similar ways. But as you were talking there about a survival horror game, I'm like wondering how, I have not engaged with it too much, but the Walking Dead RPG, I wonder if that has some aspects that could lean into that type of play for it.
I'm sure it does, but...
If you're listening out there, I've never played it, never read it. If you're listening out there, let us know. We'd love to know.
Oh, yeah.
I played it once, because zombies aren't generally my thing, but it was people I like, so there you go. How do mechanics support fictional positioning, and how do they sometimes actually just flatten it?
It was mentioned earlier... we have aspects from Fate, we have traits from Cortex, we have tags from any PBTA games. Those are all fictional positioning mechanics. You have created a thing that creates something in the fiction that is both true and has a mechanical element to it. Those support a gameplay that's more focused about what's happening in a scene and with a character's personality, because characters have aspects, and in Cortex, characters have traits, and sometimes in PBTA games, characters have tags. This is one of the primary ways how they support fictional positioning. A lot of games do it now. There's so many games that do it now. It's kind of like part of the lexicon.
Like, again, it's one of those things that has become more mechanized in games because it is a good way to encourage, I think, the role play and the character differentiation.
Yeah, I always find that the cool thing about it, too, we could talk about it later if we want to, but the cool thing about it is that stuff that JT was talking about, or that you were talking about, Ange, where game masters just kind of had to wing it or try to figure it out, or it was like a good habit. It actually gives the player characters and the game master ways to point to the gameplay of what you're doing, like the actual play, to be like, this thing actually matters. It's not like a weebly wobbly, timey whiny kind of thing. It's something that we can actually like rely on in play. Either way is fine with me. I've played games with it. I play games without it. It all works, but it is a nice piece that if you want to have that kind of gameplay.
Right.
On the negative side of that, if you get too many of these narrative mechanics on the table, it can be overwhelming. If anybody remembers the original version of Fate, your Spirit of the Century character had 7 aspects. It's too many.
Oof. Yeah.
They figured it out. Like, eventually they got it down to 5. And even then, once you start creating things and putting them in play on the table, if you have like 7 or 8 of them on the table in a scene, like a conflict scene, then it's really hard to like put all that together sometimes or really understand what's going on. It's like when you have too many bad guys on the table in a fight, like it just gets kind of cluttered and it can slow play down. That's what I mean by flatten it. When I'm talking about like you make this game harder to play, it makes it bogged down. It creates latency. It's not nearly as fluid then, and it doesn't feel good. And really that's what we're looking for, is a way to feel good when we're playing these games.
It's almost like the indie version of having, you know, like you as the GM have 30 bad guys on the board, and now you're trying to roll for each one of them
right.
as you're trying to rush through combat to get to the players so they can do cool things.
Indie version more, I guess, it's a loaded word way to say it, but more storytelling focused. And by storytelling, I mean you have, as a player, more control over the overarching narrative instead of just avataring for your character.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That kind of play. That's where I think a lot of these mechanics shift play towards a more, I guess, I always call it writer's table games, because you have more of a chance to be like a writer.
Yeah. JT, do you have anything to add to this?
Yeah, I agree with the statement that too many narrative mechanics in like that are active in play are overwhelming. That's why I can play Fate, because I only have 5 aspects, plus whatever environmental aspects happen to pop up temporarily. I mean, I have 5 aspects for me, but I can't run Fate, because even if I only have like 3 or 4, say 4 players, that's 20 aspects I have to memorize. I can't do cheat sheets. I mean, I can, but there's latency in the game as I think, oh, that there's an aspect that might apply here for a character, and now I'm flipping through 4 index cards with 5 aspects on each and trying to figure out which character, which aspect, and all that, and it kills the game. I can't run compels properly and smoothly. The players have to remind me, hey, I have an aspect you can compel in this situation, which kind of kills the mood of a compel, really, in my opinion. So I love Fate as a system, but I cannot run it. I don't have the mental faculty to rote, memorize 20 aspects, not counting my NPC or environmental aspects on top of that. So
I would agree that is probably one of the harder aspects of running. Ha! Aspects.
That was good. That was funny.
Of running Fate. And like in even in D&D, where you can have your, you know, your ideal, your bonds, your flaws. These are all the things that are supposed to have the character earn inspiration.
Right.
I have no idea what any of those are.
Same.
On my player character's sheets. I know what my characters are, but if I'm the GM, I don't remember those. I remember the gist of who the character is. I know who the character is in terms of the session I am bringing to the table and the ways I expect them to be engaging with things and how I've set it up for them. But if mechanically supposed to lean on those specific things, that gets rough.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm with both of you about Fate. The more and more I talk to people about Fate, and if anybody has listened to me over the course of many years of this, like, they know I'm a fan of Fate. It's old tech these days, and I don't really play it much anymore. But that game, from everything that I've heard from everybody out there, it's just hard to run. Like, it's a hard game to facilitate. I've only ever heard half the people I talk to are like, this game's hard. I'm like, well, okay, this game's hard. Like, that has to be true then. It jives in my head. I get that. But these narrative mechanics, this narrative positioning stuff, if you have it in your game, it's not a GM mechanic. It's a table mechanic. Like, everybody has to contribute to it or it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that can be really hard for people that are used to playing where the game master has more of the control, which, you know, D&D, the game master has a majority of the control around a lot of things.
Do you think this is similar to the way PBTA games are? You know, the players are supposed to describe what they're doing and then the GM calls for the move. But there are times where the players are trying to put themselves in the position to use a particular move and you're on a different wavelength from the GM, and that can cause a speed bump in the game.
It can. It's not a hard one to fix, and I agree with you. Everything you just said is yes. All moves in PBTA games are essentially narrative positioning moves,
mm-hmm.
right? You have to, when you do X, you trigger this move.
Right.
Yeah.
That's how those games play. Everything about PBTA is narrative positioning. You have to have a nice table culture of, if you don't have in mind what I have in mind, then we have to talk about it so that we can get on the same wavelength.
Right.
And that can create a bit of latency. But I think it's worthwhile. Those games flow so well when you have that state going, that flow state going, where people understand what's going on from all sides.
Right. We've kind of brushed up against this, but what do we do when we run into a disconnect between what's happening in the narrative and what the mechanics in the game are doing?
I think this is where we experience cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is where the thing that we're trying to do doesn't match the thing that is actually occurring in the mechanics or the narrative, either way. I think for me, I found three things. I would love to hear if either of you know of others. We try to make sense of it in our heads and just move on. We get frustrated and disconnect from the game that we're playing. We try to reframe it through the fiction via discussion with the people at the table. Those are the three ways that you deal with when this happened.
Right.
It's probably happened to all three of us in games many, many, many times over the years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I do think there is also a certain degree of, like, I'm thinking of D&D and hit points. Hit points are supposed to be an abstract representation of the character's ability to function in combat. And a lot of times players will want to make it mean an actual wound or actual injury. And I've seen running into problems where, you know, you're trying to keep the flow of the game going because you're not down and out until you're under zero hit points. But some players will not connect with that. And this can usually sometimes be an old school player versus new school ideas, but I've seen it even in that level of cognitive dissonance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just accept that, you know, you have infinite hit points until you have zero hit points, really. I mean, you have full capability of your character, the monster, the whatever, until you have zero capability. It's a switch. It's an on-off. And you slowly get whittled down until the switch gets flipped off. And I've just accepted that with D&D because I've played it for so long. It's just, I don't know. I just accept it for what it is.
Yep.
The most wild thing that I saw in role-playing games that made me switch my head about it, and I'm with you all. I had that problem too. I'm like, this makes no sense. Like, you're getting bumps and bruises and whatnot until you're at zero and then you're down. Which is fine because it's what creates a lot of the heroic fantasy aspect of those games, right? Of that, of any game that uses that idea. But if you just change that word from hit point to hit protection, boy, does that change how you view the whole space, right?
Oh, sure.
Then when somebody narrates like them getting hurt doing that, I'm like, it's hit protection. You actually didn't get hurt, right? Like, you're not hurt until you're at zero.
Right.
Words have power.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
And I mean, you can still add flavor to these things as they're happening. In one of my games, we had a high level barbarian who had the abilities that, like, you took her to zero, she makes a con save, she's still up with one hit point. And, you know, we're all flavoring that she's standing there raging at everything with her guts exposed and she's still swinging, because that's what made sense for the narrative of what was happening and the way the mechanics were keeping her character up, despite the fact that she should have dropped like three rounds ago.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and on the frustrated and disconnect side of the cognitive dissonance, I was a player in a second edition AD&D game, playing a human fighter, and I had rolled an 1899 strength. So I was one percentile point from the maximum human strength. And we encountered some spiders that had captured and wrapped up in their nest halfling villagers that were hanging from a tree. And I was like, okay, we ended up killing the spiders. The cocoon, that's the word I'm looking for, the cocoon halflings were still like writhing in their cocoon, so we knew they were alive. And I was like, cool, can I just cut them from the tree, not let them drop, and stick one of them to my body, and then cut another one, and then climb down the tree one-handed? And the game master said, no, they're too heavy.
That makes zero sense.
I was like, but halflings weigh like 35 pounds, man. You know, and my carry limit is like 600. I'm climbing a tree. Let's cut that in half. And, you know, and I just want to stick one because they're in sticky cocoons. And he established they were sticky, not me. His plan of action was, when half of the halflings were rescued, more spiders are going to show up. Now I'm cutting its timer in half, right? Because I'm doing two in one trip. And he could have just had the spiders show up at any time. But he was like, no, there's eight halflings. I'm going to have the additional spiders show up in four rounds. So if you free all the halflings in four rounds, that blows up my plan. So no, you can't do that. And I was like, cool, I'm done. And he's like, okay, well, let me give you experience points if you've got to leave early. And I said, no, I'm done.
Yep.
I'm not coming back. You don't get it, man.
Yeah. Again, that's the, you know, GMs need to learn their skills.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. There's a lot of this that's on paper that's encouraging you on how to run games, but there's a lot of it that you learn from experience, and it comes easier to some people than others. And that sounds like, again, we're also talking AD&D second edition.
Yeah.
That sounds like a GM who had not developed the ability to pivot when the players take things in a slightly different direction than they expected.
And we were also traveling between two cities, two villages, whatever it was, and we, from starting point to destination, he had all the big giant poster maps taped to like cardboard boxes leaning on his wall, so you can see all the maps of Forgotten Realms. It was awesome. And I found where we were at, and I was like, oh, it's about a 10-day travel. So I was like, hey, Game Master, it looks like it's a 10-day travel. You know, do you agree with my measurements? And he goes, oh, no, there's no accurate maps of the Forgotten Realms ever printed. I was like, wait a minute. It's an imaginary place. Any map is accurate? Right? I was like, so this guy had a lot of issues, including keeping his apartment clean. So I had multiple I had multiple reasons to bail, but the whole you can't carry more than one halfling at a time broke me.
I love these conversations, like these moments in discussing these things, because it's like a learning moment. And one of my favorite exercises to do, and I encourage anybody to do these, is decide what you would have done in that situation. For me, I would have been like, yeah, man, you can throw a halfling on your back. It'll stick there, no problem. If you want, you can throw two, but it'll reduce your dexterity by 3 points.
There you go.
Yeah.
Because not because you're not strong enough, but because they're cumbersome at that point.
Uh-huh.
They're like in your way.
Yeah.
How cool is that? You just got a choice to try that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with the maps thing, I kind of had to play with this when I was running my Zendrick campaign, because Zendrick magically defies being able to be mapped.
Oh, neat.
It's like in the text of the game, it's nearly impossible to map. But at the same time, I've got players traveling through this area. They need to have some degree of understanding of, you know, where they're going, what they're doing, and so on and so forth. So we basically played it as sometimes it'll take 3 days to get to this place you've been before. Some days it's going to take five, you know, and you're traveling the same path. It's just sometimes the magic that's inherent in those jungles is just playing with you.
Right. That's cool world building right there.
Yeah. You can just say, hey, it's, you know, you think it's going to take about X amount of time. You're pretty sure where you're going is in this direction. You've been there before. So at that point, maybe I'd give them advantage on their survival roll to follow the trail or whatever. But it's, you know, you play with the narrative without screwing over the players.
Yeah.
In that case that you were in, JT, I would have been like, yeah, you think it's about 10 days, but the maps are never super reliable. So you think that's about what it'll take, but you're not sure.
Sure. Yeah. And my plan was to buy double the amount of rations I needed for the trip. Because, you know, 10 days is never a true 10-day travel, because you always encounter trouble, because that's the whole point.
Is any of this related to the rule of cool, or what is even the rule of cool?
Absolutely, it's related to the rule of cool. The rule of cool is a narrative positioning thing that we do, whether you like it or not. So the rule of cool is stated as, you have something happen that doesn't make sense within the guidelines of the story's reality, or even the mechanics and how they function in the game, but it's too cool to not include. Now, the definition that I got, the story's reality part, is from TV Tropes. That's what rule of cool means. So we have to like modify that for role-playing games.
Right. My experiences with rule of cool have usually been that if something comes up that the mechanics aren't supporting, or there's not an easily understood way to do what we want to do in the mechanics, so we let it happen because we come up with some way to make it work because it fits within the narrative. But it sounds like there's other ways people have kind of run into this head first.
In reality, there's nothing wrong with the rule of cool. It is a perfectly legitimate thing to do in role-playing games. I just have come to the point where I would prefer, my preference, this is just a preference, is I prefer my mechanics and my narrative to like meet up together in some way. So When someone tries to do something that feels like it's slightly outside of the mechanics, I'm trying to figure out how to mold the mechanics to like give them a choice or a chance at the thing.
Right.
So they're still playing the game, if that makes sense.
Now, I do think that there have been tendencies within the gaming hobby to, you know, say, always go with the rule of cool. And that can end up causing problems because GMs start to feel like they have to allow almost anything, which is where you can get in the same situation as the GMs that like want to start a campaign and they feel like they have to accept any character a player brings to the table, even if it breaks the constraints of the campaign they're trying to start up. And so there are limits there.
Only Sith and game masters with too much ego believe the rule of cool is the only thing you can do.
Yeah, for me, I'm okay with the rule of cool, because I use it in my fiction all the time, because that's kind of where you get amazing stories, and then translating that into tabletop role-playing, exceptional gameplay. Like, you know, you leave the session with the story about your character or someone else's character that you're going to tell about, you know, talk about for years down the road. I just do my best, both as a player and a game master, to make sure the rule of cool doesn't turn into the theorem of absurdity. Right, just be reasonable. Not every game, actually, I'm gonna go out on a limb here, and it's a very short limb, to say that every published game has blind spots, meaning there are things that your players are going to want to do with their characters that the mechanics don't directly address. And GURPS might be the one exception if you include all of the books, like all 800 books, right? They probably covered it at some point. You just got to find the right page on the right rule book.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Yeah, agreed.
And that way also lies the fallacy of trying to be simulationist and come up with a rule for every contingency, which is just impossible.
Right. I had was playtesting a role-playing game I made 20-something years ago. And one of the players in the playtest was like, oh, I flipped through the book. You don't have rules for mounted combat, so this game sucks. I was like, did you have fun? He's like, oh, no, I had a blast. This was a phenomenal game. I had so much fun with it, but you don't have mounted combat rules. So, you know, you fail.
Look, that person had an opinion.
Yes.
That's really all it was. I don't even know that it's necessarily a wrong opinion. I don't think that them saying that this game fails is the right thing, but yeah, it's definitely not the game that they thought was the way that it should be put together for what would be quality.
Yeah.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it wasn't good.
Yeah, and no, it was like, but I have the writing skill is in the book. I just didn't address, like, you know, doing combat maneuvers while on horseback. And that was like a paragraph that I added, you know, if you're in combat on your horse, you got to make a riding check before your attack check to, you know, see if you're maintaining control of your mount, blah, blah, blah. Super easy fix.
You want to make it simpler? Just be like, add the advantage, disadvantage mechanic to it. And if you're like not a trained rider, then you have disadvantage on your riding attacks. Like, we could simplify this stuff. We can all sorts of things to like streamline it.
There's a lot of angles there. Yeah.
JT is also right. Like, no game is going to cover everything completely. And it may still be an absolutely brilliant game for the other areas it does cover.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, you're going to run into these things. So you have to find the balance between the game system that promotes the story and narrative you're hoping to tell with that game and your players, and figuring out how to adjudicate when stuff comes up that feels like it should make sense, but doesn't.
There's a thing that I believe about game mastering that I would hope that other people might think about and adopt. And it's that once you start running the game, you're still designing.
Mm-hmm.
All game masters are game designers.
Oh yeah.
There's nothing wrong with you designing your one-off house rule in the middle of a game when you need to fix the things so you don't have that cognitive dissonance. In a lot of ways, I used the rule of cool when I was much younger to eventually get to that point. I was like, well, how can I use the mechanics of the game to actually make this make sense in the narrative that wants to be had there? It's one of those skills that eventually you get around to developing if you want to have that tool in your toolkit.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things I will do sometimes when a player comes up with an unorthodox way to do something and it sounds fun for the scene, but I don't want it to become something they rely on as a crutch, I will allow, you know, kind of based on rule of cool, okay, we're going to go with that this time. These are the rules we're going to use for it. This is not something you can do again in the future unless there are extremely extenuating circumstances. Like summon 6 horses above 3 flesh golems to cause bludgeoning damage. I allowed it once, but I told them we're not doing this again. You know, you can have those moments where it's like, okay, that is a really unorthodox way to do this. I'll allow it this once.
Yeah, so for some GM advice there, I use a phrase called rulings, not rules.
Yeah.
So when a player comes up with that zany idea, I'll be like, cool, here's how we're going to do it this time, because I'm not going to bake up like full-blown mechanical rules for it. I'm just going to do a ruling on the fly, so we're not pausing the game, low latency. We're going to do it quick and dirty. Oh, you want to do that? Okay, this skill is close enough. Make a skill check at a -3 because that skill's not really designed to do that. If you're successful, you pull it off. If not, then the attempt fails or whatever, right? Just a quick and dirty ruling. And then if it's something they want to persistently do between sessions, I'll collaborate with you on Discord to come up with more firm, fair rules that will house rule into the game system. Or I'll find an actual rule that supports what they're trying to do that's already, you know, printed in the game mechanics if it exists.
I love risk versus reward in those moments, right? Like, which is my version of rulings, not rules. I'm like, oh man, you want to do this? Like, this sounds like this, so I'll let you try this, but if you fail, or if you fail, this bad thing's going to happen. That's where I usually get to with when people try to get outside of the game's rules. I'm like, well, you're asking me to design a thing, so I'm going to make it interesting. I'm going to increase the difficulty or the consequence for the positive benefit that you want. Like in your case with the summons, Ange, I think what you put out there is perfectly great. Like, that's a great way to handle it. I tend to do summon monsters as, like, they remember you and they talk to their friends. So, like, if you did that to a bunch of horses and dropped them, they're going to talk to all their friends. And the next time you do that, they're not going to be very happy about it. Like, whoever you summon to do that, they're going to attack you after they get dropped on somebody.
Oh, yeah.
But that's me. I'm that way.
What can GMs do to promote more narrative engagement and have the game run smoother?
Let's talk about D&D or its 5e cousins, because, I mean, that's what most people play, right? Like, 90% of the population, mm-hmm. 80% of the population plays role-playing games, plays those games. Inspiration is that tool. I think as a GM, you will need to redefine how you get inspiration a little bit by trying to find what kind of narrative tropes you want to have in your game. We mentioned this a little bit earlier. That's when fictional position becomes a part of the gameplay and gives your players a reason to become more engaged with the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Also, like, if you're not most people, I'm kind of right there with you, but I also really like playing D&D. Like, I play lots of games.
Yeah, I love D&D. I happen to do another podcast, right? That talks about D&D a lot.
It's called Thaka with Advantage. Two friends have been playing D&D a long time, get together and talk about Dungeons & Dragons. Join Ange and Jared every other Thursday.
Hey, that's our blurb for this episode.
Oh, there you go. Head. Pre-blurb.
JT, what about you?
I'm going to have a quick one of lead by example. Have named NPCs or important enemies use narrative control to change the scene up.
So good.
Right? Just show the players that it can be done and how it's done. So that'll get their gears moving. So they're like, oh, the goblins at the top of the canyon are levering this boulder down on us to start a rock slide. That's not just an attack. That changes the scene up. So that will motivate them to maybe do something to bad guys in a similar manner down the road if they have high ground. They, you know, hopefully they learn from those types of experiences and put them to use. I wouldn't have every goblin try to claim narrative control because that path leads to insanity, right? If you have 30 goblins all trying to, you know, now if you have 30 goblins as a cohesive group trying to do a specific one narrative control effort, I think that's okay, but don't have every goblin be independent. That's just, oof, that's too much.
I think the core of this is in just trying to get your players into the narrative to begin with. Always interact with the characters on an in-game level. Never use the players' names unless you really just need to get the players' attention. Talk to them as their characters, use their character names, have the NPCs address them directly. Remind them of what they know from the setting of the game that the player may not be remembering. The PC lives in this world, the player doesn't. So there's going to be things that the PC should be aware of that the player isn't. So it's always fine to give them those clues. But keep the narrative front and center in the way you run the game. And if you have a situation where you have players who keep popping out of it and diverting from the narrative, have a conversation. I still say, like, 90% of player problems can be solved by having a conversation outside of game.
Pretty much everything in role-playing games is about conversing.
Oh.
It's about how we have the conversation, which is the important thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm with you. What you're talking about is competency and knowledge of the characters, right?
Yes.
You say it all the time on other shows. You've said it on this show a bunch of times. It is a version of narrative positioning. Like, mm-hmm. your
oh, yeah.
character is narratively positioned in certain ways to know certain things, depending
yes.
on who they are and what they've learned and all that good stuff and everything that's happened to them up to that point in the game.
You're not taking away any agency from the players to say, hey, your character would know this information.
Yeah.
You're just giving them more to work with that they should have, but they're not, because they are human beings that have a 9-to-5, 40-hour-a-week job, two kids, a house that has a leak, and all this other stuff going on. And your game on Saturday is their chance to relax and have some fun. And they haven't been able to absorb a, you know, 300-page setting book. It's like you wanna work with your players to help keep them in the narrative.
Yeah.
I have a question, and it might not be for the two of you. Maybe if one of you can answer this, it'd be great. But for those who are listening, if any of you folks out there are OSR players, like you play Shadow Dark or Mouse Ritter or The Black Hack or games like that, right? Whatever game you saw on Ben Milton's Questing Beast channel. I'm thinking about playing some Shadow Dark sometime soon. Is that a faux pas to do that for those characters? Because I'm curious, because I would just naturally do that and tell them what their characters know, but I feel like that might not be the play style of games like that.
Yeah, I think I've played Shadow Dark once. Sean Kelly, the famous It Depends Sean Kelly, was running a West Marches style Shadow Dark campaign that I played in as long as it was running. And it definitely, again, OSR games lean more on the player being clever than the character's stats saying they're clever. So there's possibly a degree there. But at the same time, there were times where we would ask Sean questions about the setting that our characters would know, and he never hesitated to give us that information. It just may have been initiated by the player asking the question rather than the GM reminding the player of what they should know.
Right. That makes sense.
Yep. If you grew up in a D&D style traditional fantasy world, you're going to grow up hearing about trolls. Now, do you know they regenerate? Maybe, maybe not. Do you know that you need acid fire to prevent that regeneration? Maybe, maybe not. But you've definitely heard of trolls. Trolls are not, it's like hearing about elephants, even if you've never seen one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I give a very high level, like general education skill check, or a base knowledge, or even just an intelligence roll if there's no skills in the game, to see what people know about trolls the first time they encounter them. And some people have rebelled against that. Well, how would I have known? It's like, well, maybe your grandfather encountered one, right? And it's an old grandpa story.
Frame it as a the myths that you heard around the campfire.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Same goes with any special creature like hydras, you know, cut off the head, you get two, so on and so forth. So.
And there are old school players who will resist that type of thing. There's no way my character wouldn't know. That's metagaming. It's like,
yeah.
The world is not a blank slate. You didn't grow up never hearing any stories.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it's like, if you make this role, you heard some stories about trolls or hydras.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And to basically help keep the game rolling forward. Speaking of players and metagaming and what they know or what they don't know, what can players do to help themselves within the narrative?
So pay attention to the details. Like there might be gaps in knowledge or descriptions or setting details or even scene descriptions, and see if you can fill those gaps with the narrative positioning to enhance your abilities or maybe degrade the abilities of enemies. Or even if there's a special something that is described but doesn't seem to have a purpose, maybe you can give it a purpose. That there's a scene location thing that I really want to do where a natural gas vent builds up pressure over time, and there's a burning torch right next to the little bitty hole that exhausts the natural gas. And when it builds up to a certain pressure, the natural gas exhausts, hits the torch, and whoosh, it's like a little mini fireball, but it's not a magic fireball. It's just natural gas venting and getting blown up. I want to do that and have several of those around the room to see if the players can figure out the timing on the little mini fireballs and shove an opponent into the vent or near the vent at the time that it's about to blow up. or move away when it's about to blow up, or you know, whatever, something like that. That is huge opportunity for narrative control right there.
That sounds like a ton of fun.
Yeah, sounds like a really fun encounter.
You also made me think of the Critical Role chair. The legend is that Matthew Mercer basically described a chair with some interesting detail, and then the players absolutely fixated on it because they thought it was important, and he was just having fun describing the scene. And he finally had to be like, it's just a chair.
Right.
So it's like,
that happens.
You need to, like, if your players fixate on something, you either need to make it important or just be real clear it's time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Let them have a few moments of fun with the non-important fancy item and then give them a nudge to move on.
What I would say here is ask questions, but don't hide your intentions within the questions. There are so many times where I will have a player asking me questions and I will be trying to answer them until I finally have to ask, what are you trying to achieve? It's like you can metagame a little to explain what it is you're hoping for your character to find here that they can do something with. We had an incident in the game this past Saturday where we fought a big bad demon devil prince and killed him, and his body disappeared into the air. And one of the players kept asking, did he leave anything behind? Did he leave anything behind? The GM thought he was looking for loot.
Sure.
And the GM's like, no, just this and this. And finally, it turns out what the player wanted was something that belonged to that character, that devil, so it could be given a proper burial.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it was a very interesting story beat, but because he wasn't telling us what he was looking for, the GM was missing what he needed. So it's like, it is okay to be upfront with what you are hoping to achieve in the scene. Is there a chandelier in this room that looks like it could hold my weight? You can ask the questions, but don't hide what you want underneath the questions.
One of my favorite things to ask as a game master is, what are you looking for here?
Yes.
Because if your players aren't used to just asking for what they want, then you can draw it out of them. But
right.
It's hard to recognize that sometimes when you got 8,000 other things going on.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And a lot of old school players, again, show me on the dollar where the GM in the past hurt you.
Right.
A lot of these players didn't want to reveal what they were looking for because then the GM would use it against them. I'm not that GM. I'm the cream puff. Tell me what you want. I want you to do cool and wild and brave things.
Even if you are playing an old school game, if you're the referee, like playing it as a referee, then that shouldn't be the thing, right? The adversarial thing is rough, man. Like,
right.
It's just, it makes the game unfun for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, I got games you can play if you want to kill the people on the other side. Like, there's Star Wars, the Star Wars board game. There's Descent. There's
Battletech. What,
Mansions of Madness. Yeah.
Shadows over Camelot.
Yeah, yeah, man. Like, I mean, all these board games do that really, really well. Role-playing games, I feel like they don't do that very well. I guess on my end, because I should probably answer this question too, it really does depend on the game. It really does depend on the game master. But as a player, I think it helps if you understand where the fictional position can be leveraged in the game that you're playing. There's often mechanics associated with the concept of fictional positioning. So you need to like try to figure out where those are and where your GM actually stands on those ideas, if they're even interested in them at all. Like if you're playing certain games that have lots and lots and lots of like mechanics to them. I mean, I played a bunch of Draw Steel. I played like 28 hours of Draw Steel. I don't remember there being a whole lot of fictional positioning in that game because there's just so much going on, right? There's like lots of resources and meta mechanics and meta currencies, and it's a dudes on map game, right? Folks on map game. find out where if you're playing Fate, then you know where exactly they are.
Right, exactly. And I think in any game, there is going to be any role-playing game that we're playing, there's going to be a degree of we are rolling the dice and telling a story together. So there is going to be some aspect of it, but how does it engage with the mechanics? And how can you pull those mechanics into play for what you want to achieve with your character?
Yeah. The only thing I have to add to that statement is like the only thing I want is that the game also has a say in the story. Otherwise, why are we playing the game?
Right. Because otherwise, then you're just sitting around the table doing collaborative storytelling.
Which is also a fun activity to do. It's just not what I'm trying to get out of playing a tabletop role-playing game.
This is probably a slight tangent, but I have struggled with GM-less games because it feels like the narrative doesn't really have any cohesive hold to it or direction that it's going. And some of these games can be a lot of fun with the right group of players, but I always find myself coming back to a more traditional role-playing game where I've got the GM playing maestro and directing the symphony of what we're doing together.
I'm generally with you. I've played a bunch of GM-less games, but some of them just, I have a hard time with Fiasco. I haven't played second edition though, so I don't want to talk too much about that, but my experiences have been mixed. I've probably had 50% a good time, 50% not a good time, because it's that thing. It's like you have to all have everybody like kind of like zoomed in together, and if somebody gets upset or doesn't feel like they're being heard or like their things are being okay, they can really like push the narrative in a way that people weren't expecting, and that can be fun. But it's also like we have to like figure it out from that point then. But
right.
That's what that game is, right? Like it's not a, there's not like a true through line. Like we don't know what the through line is until we're playing.
Right.
Until we get done, really.
Nope. Anyway, we should probably start wrapping up. Any last thoughts on this topic?
I have several. So to me, tabletop role-playing games, they are games. Games to me are about choices, and utilizing fictional positioning is just another type of choice that you can make depending on the kind of system that you're playing or whatever. I mean, it could be spell slots or action economy or martial dice or who your character's in the setting or what their position is in a current situation, scene, or encounter. Like, all those things, to me, are potentially fictional positioning and a choice that you can make off of that. That kind of play, when you're utilizing fictional positioning, just has some more wiggle room around it. So it might require a bit more discussion, but I think it's worth it because, to me, the greatest strength of the TTRPG is that wiggle room within the gameplay to create the fiction.
JT? Anything you want to add?
Not really. I think I've said it all on this topic, but just kind of throw one more bit on there. If you're having fun doing it, you're doing it right.
Mm-hmm. I would caveat that if you're having fun and everyone else at the table is also having fun, something is going right.
Yeah. Sure. The plural you. Yeah. If y'all are having fun, y'all are doing
y'all
it
are
right.
Having fun.
Yeah.
There you go. There's my Texas roots coming out.
Because I've seen some of those adversarial GMs. They're having a blast.
Oh, hell yeah, they are. Yeah, but nobody else is.
Anyway, getting us out of here, this show is funded by the Gnomes Who Patreon. You too can Patreon back up by following the Patreon link on the Gnomes Who website to the Gnomes Who Patreon. We love doing this, and our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, so if you're enjoying us, check out Thaka with Advantage that Chris talked about earlier in the episode. You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, along with GnomeStew on Facebook, Threads, Instagram, wherever. We're out there. We're not super active, but we are out there. Gnomes, is there anything else you want to give a shout out to today?
Yes. So there's this website called thestreetsofavalon.com. That is the game I've been working on for like 3 years. That is the version 3 of the book will be out when I'm done laying it out. Boy, is that a nightmare. Anyways, all of series 2 of Under the Lamplight is out. That is the companion podcast. We're about to start recording series 3. And there's been a series going on there called The 5 Most Dangerous Streets in Avalon. I think 4 of them are out right now when you hear this, and the 5th one will be out very soon after that.
And it's a fantastic podcast to listen to just to get ideas on, like, not just how to build a city, but like how to run a city-based game. It's just the ideas that Chris and Brett put together and just like riff on are just highly entertaining and very inspiring. I'm a fan.
The other one I have is Min Maxed. This is a pretty fun actual play on YouTube created by the folks from Sellsword Arts, Master Bensai, Bloomnick, and Jacques the Whipper, with Tater the Bard as the game master. If you don't know who those folks are, they are all martial artists type people out there, except for Jacques, who's Jack the Whipper. He is a famous Renaissance fair person. He travels all over the place. He's got a pretty prominent shorts channel these days. They release episodes every 2 weeks. The episodes are only about an hour to an hour and 15 long. It's very much just 7 people playing a game of D&D, and Tater has already had them off track and sourced the table to have them create things in the city to try to get them back on track. Pretty fun. And as a different kind of start, they begin in the middle of a heist that goes sideways.
If I remember correctly, they're all relatively new to D&D, or at least Jacques the Whipper is.
I mean, they've all been playing a ton of Baldur's Gate 3, so I mean, there's that. I think Jacques the Whipper has got like 300 hours of Baldur's Gate 3 played, so you know.
JT, what about you?
All right, so I'm going to talk about a short story of mine called The Emerald Cube, and it recently came out about a week ago as we're recording. in an anthology called Tentacles and Tides. In case you can't tell, it's kind of a water creature, deep, dark depths themed anthology. And I landed a short story in that guy. It's available in most online stores in ebook and print. And a link to the Books to Read page for Tentacles and Tides will be in the show notes.
Nice. We have made it to April, and June is not too far in the future, which means Origins Game Fair. If you are interested in going, event registration opens on April 26th at noon. And if you like RPGs, you want to try and get into event reg as soon as possible so you can get some sweet spots in some RPGs. Doesn't mean there's not good stuff afterwards, but April 26th is event reg for Origins, which is mid-June. I'm sure I'll mention it again with the exact dates, but there you go.
I'm sure Ange will be there running games for Matinee Adventures.
I will. I'm going to be running the June adventure for my Tales from the Loop series. It's the finals countdown.
It's the finals countdown. I got to stop. We're going to get demonetized.
So do you think we've put ourselves in the correct narrative position to avoid being thrown in the stew?
Hell no.
No, but I'm going to spend a Benny to get out of it anyway.
Smart.
Sploosh.